they seem to be interested in nuclear stuff.
There is an absolute connection to nuclear.
Yeah.
Absolute.
Do you think it's the power unlock more than the destructive force?
I think...
The year was 1964. We're on Vandenberg Air Force Base. A classified program is taking place called ATLAS, testing dummy nuclear warheads being launched from intercontinental ballistic missiles. A photo instrumentation specialist, Lieutenant Bob Jacobs, was tasked with capturing the launch of the two missiles from 100 miles north of Vandenberg at Big Sur.
And the missile popped up through the fog. All we saw was a smoke trail going off into subspace.
But what he caught on camera would change his life and his understanding of the universe forever. A flying saucer flying 8,000 miles per hour not only seemed to encircle the missile, it shot four directed energy beams at it, causing it to tumble off its intended trajectory.
And I said, it looks like we got a UFO.
We know that UAP are interested in nuclear capabilities and our military capabilities. It's no different than we go to the Serengeti and we watch the cheetahs preying upon the antelope. It's interesting to watch. What are their hunting techniques? What are their capabilities?
That's Lou Elizondo, former director of ATIP, the government's Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program, which studied UFOs from 2007 to 2012. Unfortunately, you'll have to wait a couple of weeks for my interview with him.
You know, there's a lot of stuff I can't say. Because, you know, it hasn't been declassified yet.
But at the end of this video, Lou gives one of the most concise and accessible explanations of space-time metric engineering, which also accounts for the connection between UFOs and nuclear weapons. In March of 1967, at Malmstrom Nuclear Facility in Montana, Captain Robert Salas was operating an underground control center capable of deploying 10 80-kiloton nuclear warheads at any moment. In the early morning, Salas gets a call from a terrified guard next to the warheads above ground. He sees a red glowing object hovering directly over the missiles, moving at incredible speeds, making right angle turns and stopping on a dime. Then all of a sudden, Salas's entire control panel below ground turns from green to red. The nukes have been rendered completely inoperable, presumably by this mysterious red object. These are just two of over 100 cases journalist Robert Hastings has meticulously documented for his aptly named book, UFOs and Nukes. But there are other researchers who have contributed important work to this topic. Famous ufologist Jacques Vallée's new book describes a crash at Trinity, New Mexico on August 17, 1945. This was a month after the first nuclear test on U.S. soil at Trinity, and it was also 2 days after the atom bomb was used in Nagasaki, Japan. From hundreds of declassified Air Force documents, we now know that UFO sightings were happening across all American nuclear production, missile storage, and deployment sites throughout the Cold War. Plutonium enrichment sites like Hanford, Washington and Savannah, South Carolina, or large nuclear stockpiles at Fort Hood, Texas, or Killeen base camps. From Los Alamos to Sandia to Malmstrom to F.E. Warren, the list goes on. We now even know that because of all these bizarre UFO sightings around U.S. nuclear facilities, an emergency conference was held at Camp Hood, Texas, which included the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, the Army Counterintelligence Command, and the FBI. But this begs a very important question. Why the hell would UFOs be interested in human nuclear capabilities? Your typical explanation might be like the one posited in the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still.
You should let me go.
Basically, the aliens are just benevolent and want to protect us from destroying ourselves. But I think there are other, possibly more interesting explanations involving nuclear energy output and its connection to the propulsion possibly being used by these crafts, or the dimensions they traverse.
Everything that is in my videos, you can find somewhere else and like sourced, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're a curator.
To discuss this, I invited my friend Red Panda Koala over.
I'm not in a position where it's like people are telling me secrets. For my own safety and security, I don't want to be like known as like—
Yeah, you don't want to be like, in that position.
He's like the Ken Burns of UFOs. His YouTube channel is incredibly rich and detailed. If you want deeper coverage that goes well beyond sensationalist and surface level overviews of the Gimbal and Nimitz videos, he's your guy. I've linked his channel in the description, so go check it out. Red and I discuss all of the theories around the UFO nuclear connection, but also get into some insane facts around UFOs people don't know. This ranges from Donald Trump's family connection to UFOs, to the fascinating role Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell plays in the whole UFO story. So lean back, hit subscribe, and help me unravel the bizarre connection between UFOs and nukes with today's American alchemist, Red Panda Koala.
Different parts of the brain have different activities.
But you know that, don't you?
Maybe you should interview me.
If you were to characterize this modern push for disclosure, it's sort of a motley crew, and it's a really interesting group of people. It's not like you have this like one straight up Snowden character just like revealing everything all at once.
Yeah.
It does feel like even the people who are pushing for disclosure are respecting the limits of security clearances, and they want things put out in a certain way. And I think the coordinated effort in that vein was To the Stars Academy, which you do a great video on. Tom DeLonge was sort of chosen, interestingly, as the head of this. He's a former Blink-182 frontman. Still a weird story. You have a musician who is super interested in UFOs, like, and he would always, Travis Barker would talk about his interest on tour and stuff. But then he's like getting in touch with Lockheed Martin and meeting with executives there.
I have been in secure facilities, the codes and the alarms and the guns and all that shit to get into there, and they lock you in and they're airtight, and I have been trying to, say smart words.
He was seen as probably cool among young people, which I think is very, if you're trying to disseminate something, or destigmatize it or whatever, that might be.
He's a UFO nerd. Like, he knows the lore. He knows. Yeah. He's read books. He said he would read UFO books on the Blink-182 buses and stuff like that.
I think it's amazing that it's sort of a, true, civilian hero story until he, goes on this, kind of cringy podcast tour and then, acts just, really cool. Like, I'm in touch with these people or whatever.
I'm not going to say any more than that.
You said so much.
I know.
Weird what you can and can't say.
Well, I could tell you other shit offline, probably.
Okay, offline. I can't wait to end this podcast.
People will call him a glowy, or will say he's a shill for the government, which to a degree you could say, right? Because he's out here saying we shouldn't really be angry at the cover up, or you kind of have to understand where they were coming from.
Right. Well, in the email, it's not even like you could see in the emails with John Podesta. He's saying, I want the government to come off as cool here. I don't want to, I want them to, in the beginning, we got to make it seem kind of irreverent, but then afterwards, we'll get them with the, government's doing a good job and get people excited about the government's, treatment of this whole thing.
Which is, for me, it's is he totally a shill, or does he realize, the only way you're going to get the government to, go on board with this at all
is to do that.
You can't be we're going to just make.
No, that's your pit. Maybe you want to know so badly.
Your pitch is just
give me the access and I'll be the guy. I don't know.
Before 2017, this topic was totally different. And even I think as recently as 2012, the Obama administration was asked if they investigate UFOs, and it was just kind of laughed off.
The aliens won't let it happen. They reveal all their secrets.
And then, what was it, last year or 2 years ago, you had Obama basically giving one of the biggest statements on UFOs of a former president on some late night talk show. But
yeah, he was like, well, you'd be surprised.
There's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are.
Those are huge statements compared to 5-6 years ago.
Right.
So a lot of that is Tom DeLonge, whether people like it or not.
Yeah, you had Jimmy Carter saying he saw a UFO, which is pretty cool.
We saw a bright light appear in the distant western skies.
So, and another really great video, Trump and UFOs, which you uncovered some really interesting connections, namely with his uncle, John Trump.
My uncle was a great professor, but my uncle was a professor for years.
I even talk about my uncle was a professor at MIT. My uncle was one of the top people at MIT,
but I'm smarter than him.
John Trump, his uncle, was a really smart radar scientist and worked at the Rad Lab and also went to MIT. He was so smart that when Nikola Tesla died, he was called upon by the government to basically investigate all of his personal files and just kind of go through all of his notes and whatnot. He was an advisor to General Carl Spatz, I believe, who his name comes up a lot in even Roswell lore and stuff like that. So basically what I kind of...
He claims that he was in Washington at the time, go on a fishing trip or something.
Yes.
In fact, he flew to Texas, which is where the Roswell retrieved parts were supposedly taken before they were taken to Wright-Patterson.
Exactly.
And so, weird connection.
So during that,
and he was also very close with Vannevar Bush, John Trump.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and for people who don't know, Vannevar Bush, he was basically during World War II, like a lot of like the top scientists, but he basically just like headed this whole program for them.
And was instrumental in the Manhattan Project.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Exactly. So John Trump was in that whole circle of people, like like they were actually friends, Vannevar Bush and John Trump. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like a casual thing. Yeah. So back to the General Spatz thing. Because John Trump was so influential in radar technology, and because he was a top advisor to General Spatz, who comes up in UFO lore, I personally think he would have been involved in, for example, the 1952 wave over DC, which was a very radar-intensive wave.
And the event you're talking about is July 1952. You have saucers on the White House lawn. You know, that's a hyperbolic, but you had flying saucers over Washington, D.C. Maybe they would call John Trump.
I personally think that it would make sense.
Do you think the Majestic 12 was real? So this was like a reported committee in the I guess, 40s and 50s. And it was like, you know, Nathan Twining, James Forrestal, Vannevar Bush, people like that. Sort of people either very high up in military and intelligence or science. And I guess the reported mission was to make contact with alien, form a dialogue with alien civilizations. Do you think that there's any credence to this?
I don't know. There's a lot of disinfo when it comes to MJ-12 where I don't know. But then some people even say like the fact that somebody went out of their way to make this like super document shows like this is probably close to something that they wanted to like throw the scent off. You know what I mean?
Right.
But either way, the people in the MJ-12, the alleged MJ-12 thing, were all like in the same circles as John Trump, which is so random.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to find patterns with UFOs. It's like almost impossible. And that's like this sort of recursive unsolvability element to it, that it feels like this game of whack-a-mole. And so looking for repeatable things with UFOs, you find a couple of things, threads you can kind of pull on. And one thread is this connection with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, like a lot of the big UFO stories even have this kind of like background thread of the nuclear that you don't even realize, like Roswell was the first atomically armed bomber squadron, and they were the ones that dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. And then you have Los Alamos, like even as early as I believe like 1948, they were being seen there. But yeah, theories. What do you think?
I guess there are three possible theories that I'm sort of thinking of.
Number one, the benevolent protector theory. They are here because they don't want us to destroy ourselves.
They see these crazy death weapons and they're just like, we have to monitor this shit, like we can't have this race wipe itself out or whatever.
4 square miles leveled by one bomb.
If you listen to experiencers, you kind of hear a lot of like the first theory you had, where it's like they're our benevolent brothers, they don't want us to hurt ourselves.
Number two, they are somehow affected by the electromagnetic fallout from the nuclear weapon. Maybe gamma radiation or EMP effects from nuclear explosions mess with their flight path and pop them into our visible dimension.
They might be in some bizarre interior interdimensional fabric of reality, and then the nukes go off and then they're somehow popped into our reality.
Yeah, I've heard some of those things too. And yet Tom says that they've used nukes to like bring out down UFOs, right?
He says. Right.
The one thing we found out is that the EMP wave from a nuclear blast kind of travels through multiple dimensions. So it's like that energy is fucking up whatever's in that location, and maybe those people are like, what the fuck was that? Let's materialize into that other timeline and get those motherfuckers to stop.
If there are crashes, then why is it always end up in the hands of, you know, these specific people? And like, if it's around nuclear sites, that would make a whole lot more sense.
Number three, we are in a low-level time-based dimension that they have broken out of. Maybe sheer energy output has something to do with our ability to break out. And maybe they don't want us to break out. Or on a moral or ethical level, they just don't think we're civilized enough yet. The fourth possible explanation would be that nukes, or at least the axis of study around nukes, would lead us to somehow figuring out how to traverse space-time in unprecedented ways, and more similarly to these UFOs.
We can say that the recent sightings are in no way connected with any secret development by any department of the United States.
What happened in 1952?
The DC UFO sightings in July.
Yeah, well, I was going to say the...
Well, what else?
The first H-bomb.
The H-bomb. Tell her, yeah.
It was the first hydrogen bomb in 1952.
Yeah.
Right? And that was when we see the big wave, right? And the big, like, DC wave.
Exactly.
The concern that I have is that in 1952, what if there was someone there to hear what we said in the Pacific? Hmm. We said we are a hair's breadth away from being in possession of godlike knowledge, where we've been trapped here on this planet, unable to move beyond our own moon. If there was something or someone there to hear us, they probably heard us as saying we're on the verge of being able to come visit. That's terrifying.
If there's ever was a signal from them, like that was it, right?
Right now, an H-bomb involves something like 80 to 100 megatons of TNT. This is very theoretical, but if we can get to upwards of 10 to the 9th tons of TNT, we might be able to start folding space-time at will.
If we could manipulate variables in Einstein's equations the way we manipulate variables in Maxwell's equations, you would see certain kinds of things which tend to match claimed observations of UAP phenomena.
So, if E equals MC squared, then the only way to get this sort of space-time metric effect is if you have enough energy.
You got it, because if you do it, the only two ways to warp space-time is with mass mm-hmm. or a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. Think of mass and energy as the same thing. Mm-hmm. Mass is ice, energy as steam, mm-hmm. okay? But they're both water,
yep.
okay? So same thing kind of here, energy and mass have this relationship.
So you need to get Planck scale energy.
With that energy output, you can basically start creating little black holes at will. Now, even if we do achieve that output, there'll be all sorts of issues around microscopically distributing it and harnessing it in the form of craft propulsion. But the aliens might just be monitoring our progress as we inch closer to their level.
What is disclosure? You ask somebody like Lou Elizondo, he's like, we've already had disclosure. Yeah. Like the Pentagon said that there are these unidentified objects, you know? And then is it seeing a craft? Like, I've seen pieces of a craft. I've been with Gary Nolan. I don't know if they're real pieces of a craft, but like they seem
like.
Did
you touch those?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. Feel good?
Maybe I'm crazy because I touched them. I don't know. And they look kind of anticlimactic. So at that point, the small scale stuff, that's not disclosure.
Yeah.
You need a big scale like disc or something. And then if there's a big scale disc, you could build a big scale disc. You need to know that it has isotope ratios that we give or like some atom configuration that we don't have. Or the thing flies in a way that repeatably do it. Or you need like to see like an alien body, like aliens,
or super dramatic like modern day church committee hearing. You know what I mean? Where you just have like people just getting grilled or in Congress and just being like yes, yes.
Yeah, but even that, I sort of think we live in such a visual society, and mm-hmm. a society with. I mean, to me, it's like it's obviously like the most important, most interesting thing. Like it's like even if it's like 10% possibly true or whatever, like you should be levering a lot of your time into this stuff. And now nobody gives a
shit.
Isn't
it crazy?
It's crazy. And like, we've made a lot of progress in the last 4 or 5 years. So I don't know, even if a bunch of people, like old people came out and they're like, we did work on this.
Yeah.
I don't know how much that would change things.
That's
I think you'd need to like see a thing.
That's very true. Yeah, I think a lot of people will have to, and even then people are gonna be like, I don't believe that.
I don't believe that, yeah, yeah.
This is a op.
Mm-hmm.
We're part of the op, like, you
yeah,
know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
The Air Force is like not talking at all, like they're being super quiet, right? Mm-hmm. I think Chris Mellon's even called them out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably because they've probably done the most damage over the years. They probably have the most reputation to lose. Like Richard Doty was Air Force, right? Mm-hmm. What would happen is like a ufologist would kind of make a big break or kind of pop up onto the scene. And then in would come Richard Doty to kind of feed them disinfo and like mess with them. So
Paul Benowitz sees, you know, these sort of super advanced aircrafts being tested. And then Doty sort of enters the picture and like starts to drive him mad, like convinces him that it's a secret UFO project.
Yeah. Right? And Doty defends himself by saying like, oh, I didn't tell him anything he didn't already believe. But they were basically like literally like gaslighting him into believing like that he was in communication with these aliens, and basically like, yeah, like you said, over time he kind of withdrew from the community. Some people, like he ended up committing suicide, and some people attribute that totally to Doty, which is, that's a lot to say, right? But it shows that there's this history, right, of the government and the Air Force specifically like messing with citizens.
And then we talked about James McDonald, this famous mm-hmm. physicist. So what's his story?
So like a lot of Americans in the 50s and 60s the picture that the Air Force was projecting was that Project Blue Book was like this really official study. When you submit your sighting report, we're looking into it, we're on it. So he had a sighting in the late 50s.
I think it was 57. Savannah,
57.
Savannah,
yes,
Georgia.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
And he had a sighting, he submitted it to the Air Force. He had thought that it was everything was going well, you know what I mean? He had faith in the institution that was the Air Force. And then over time, he realized that like what he had thought Project Blue Book was, with like this full wing with like scientists and doctors and all that, it wasn't that at all. It was just like a really small group of people like creating propaganda for the government. Yeah, so he was really upset and angry, but he was really upset and angry at J. Allen Hynek, who had been for 20 years at that point, basically the mouthpiece of for the Air Force, debunking UFOs wherever he went. And it should be noted, like J. Allen Hynek would later go on to become a ufologist and like UFO researcher and expose his own role in the cover-up. A big part of the reason why he ended up flipping, if you will, or coming clean was because James McDonald went to him and was like super pissed and was like, what you're doing to science is horrible. I can't believe you're like putting your name, like you're setting humanity back so many years by putting your name, like you're a famous astronomer, you're co-signing all this stuff. And that interaction is was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back for Hynek. But to the James McDonald thing, after that had happened, he became a very vocal advocate for the UFO like problem in America and that it should be taken seriously. And in 1966, after the Michigan flap, which we were talking about earlier, there was this big push for congressional hearings and stuff like that. And he was a really vocal like science advocate for this. And a congressman like famously like mocked that he was into UFOs and stuff like that. And like apparently the entire like congressional hall like was laughing at him. Those like combination of things like really got to him to a point where he ended up committing suicide a few years after the congressional hearings and the hope that there was there.
What about Edgar Mitchell?
Oh yeah.
So who was Edgar Mitchell?
Edgar Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon. He was part of Apollo 14. Well, something interesting he did is when he went to the moon, he tried to do an experiment where he basically tried to recreate the J.B. Ryan experiment of like, guess what letter, guess what symbol. Mm-hmm. But he tried to do it while he was in orbit. It was the first ever like psychic experiment in space.
What I find so interesting about him is it almost felt like he had like a conversion experience on the way back from on Apollo 14. It was like almost like a religious conversion experience.
Yeah, that was always an interesting thing because when he got back from the moon, he went home, and because he was like seen as like a local boy but also part of the government, residents from the community of Roswell were coming forward and telling him like, hey, this happened so many years ago, and he was like, that's crazy, I don't know what to make of it. And then like shortly after that too is when Wernher von Braun like told him that like, I also kind of can corroborate what you were hearing back home about Roswell. So those combinations of experiences really propelled him to like become a big advocate. And during the 80s and 90s, and like I was saying, we take it for granted today, but in those days it was not the same. This guy was out there doing work for years.
There's a lot of occult history, occult history in NASA. Some of the nomenclature that was used for certain missions and the choosing of, you know, Launch Pad 33 and some other things were very deliberate. Mm. It wasn't, you know, happenstance. Mm.
You want to know something really trippy about Jack Parsons? Mm. So Jack Parsons was in the OTO. You know, this crazy cult. Yeah, this was with Aleister Crowley and all that. And they would do past life regressions. But his past life regression was Simon the Sorcerer. And you know Simon the Sorcerer was? He was using sort of black magic to levitate. And then he saw Peter and Paul, they were levitating because of God. And he was like,
Peter and Paul and the disciples?
The disciples. And he was like, okay, like you guys are somehow levitating higher than me, I'd love to pay for that power. So that's where the word simony comes from. Mm. And so he could fly using this sort of dark black magic sort of thing. Jack Parsons was sort of a known occultist who would do all sorts of weird sex magic rituals and also was very interested in kind of levitation. When they did a past life regression on him, apparently that was what they...
Wow.
Yeah. Dude, Skinwalker Ranch was really freaky going there.
So tell me about it. So did you feel it?
You know, it's one of these things where it was anticlimactic the day I went. Not anticlimactic in that I think the team is awesome and the experience was really cool, but anticlimactic in that I didn't see a big ass UFO fly across the grounds, or, you know, nothing insanely paranormal happened. You know, like a tri-field meter went off because of high gamma radiation. But so nothing, you know, insane. But afterwards, I definitely felt like, you know, a few weird things happened in my life.
Oh, shoot.
And like
after you'd already left, like total hitchhiker vibe?
Yeah. And again, not as explicit as like an orb went across my room. So I can't for sure say that whatever.
It's even like
that.
More troll. It's like so subtle. It's
I mean, Jacques Vallée talks about like, how do you create a real cult following? It's not by showing yourself consistently. It's like if you have every time you hit a lever, you know, some treat comes out for a dog or whatever. Yeah. They're gonna hit the lever less than if it comes out randomly. This idea of intermittent reinforcement, if they're like sort of sporadic sightings that seem very ephemeral in nature, that's how you create kind of a rabid following. And cults actually took this up as like, you know, that became their practice. And so I always think it's really subtle. There's one streak of my life where I experienced a bunch of paranormal stuff, like thing after thing after thing, and I like saw UFOs and stuff like that. But the Skinwalker thing, yeah, felt like it could have been that, or it could have just been something else.
Would you go back?
No.
No? Oh, see, there you go. That's telling, right?
Yeah. And I'm high on the openness scale. Like I would do most things that like other people are like, oh, I think that's dangerous or crazy.
Really? Yeah. Well,
you know where I do want to go though. You know, there are all the conspiracies that the moon landing was faked, and then there's the UFO conspiracy that Neil Armstrong saw like UFOs on the moon or whatever, and he came back and he was super scared. And the one possible piece of corroborating evidence to that, and I'm not proposing that, I don't necessarily think that that's true, but the one possibly kind of funny piece of additional evidence would be that the second expedition Neil Armstrong did was in 1975, and it was to a cave in Ecuador at the edge of the Amazon, and it was called the Teos Cave, and it was supposed to contain ancient alien metallic artifacts. And so clearly, Neil Armstrong believed enough in the possibility of that thing to like go into the Amazon and risk his life and try to look for it. And a BBC documentary crew followed him in there. And so I met somebody who comes from a long line of conquistadors.
Oh, nice.
His name is Luis Felipe San Salvador. And he has maps to the Teos Cave. And so I would love to go and try to find that, because Neil Armstrong was not successful.
Please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Thank you, Robert Hastings, for your work, and Red Panda Koala for your time. If you want incredible historical in-depth coverage of UFOs, please go to Red Panda Koala's YouTube channel. I've linked to it in the description of this video. And if you want more crazy content like this, please hit the like and subscribe button. Until next time, I'm Jesse Michaels, and this is American Alchemy.
Gathered in a schoolyard with about 20 other men, and we saw a bright light appear in the distant western skies, and it got closer and closer, and when it was just above the treetops, it changed color, and then it stayed there for a while, and then it disappeared into the distance. And none of us could ever imagine what it was, and I still don't know what it was.